Hi, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to our second hour as we proceed for more with our members. We're talking with Allison Adams about the Natural Health Recovery Plan, toxicity, mercury, and nutrition. And let's begin to talk about root canals, Allison. This is something that is a very important subject, of course, but it ties into the toxicity of the dentist industry overall. So what happens with during a root canal, and why is it so toxic?
Right. In order to understand that, I just need to back up a little bit and explain a little bit about tooth development. What happens when a tooth develops is that a membrane is thrown up in the fetus's mouth or whatever, and one side of it has cells known as ameloblasts, which will head away from the membrane and lay down crystalline enamel. And then the other side of the membrane has cells known as odontoblasts, which will head in the opposite direction towards the inside of the tooth, if you like, and lay down dentine, which is actually made up of lots of little tubules. And then as the teeth erupt into the mouth, the roots form and so forth. So you've got the hard enamel on the outside, crystalline. You've then got this porous dentine inside, and this is actually being maintained in function by these cells called odontoblasts. And in the middle of the tooth, you've got nerves, blood vessels, lymphatics, and everything's being transported to and from the odontoblast. The odontoblasts are actually the circulation for the dentine. So they are transporting oxygen to it. They are taking toxic waste away. They're actually repairing the teeth in function. I heard you ask Ramiel Nagel, why can't teeth repair? Well, the answer is they can. So this is the circulation for the tooth, and it actually happens that the odontoblasts are incredibly sensitive to changes in blood chemistry, and that tooth decay isn't a separate thing to other degenerative diseases. It's actually an early warning sign that your body is, your whole body chemistry is out, because the decay actually starts when the odontoblasts fail. From the inside, it starts from inside, and when the tooth isn't maintained, then the bacteria and what have you can ingress.
And that isn't that an interesting point as well with the odontoblasts that you mentioned, that we that it's something that's the decay starts from the inside of the tooth, when we're told that it's something that's because we have stress on the outside of the tooth with sugar or something like that. It means more that it's a deeper toxicity issue, and we're being depleted of calcium, I would reckon, right?
It's actually it's all to do with calcium phosphorus balance in the blood. There was a researcher called Melvin Page who did a lot of work on this, and also another one called Ralph Steinman. Melvin Page was actually, again, he went to the University of Michigan. He was a general dentist, and he actually specialized just in resolving dental disease, so gum disease and tooth decay, and that's what he did. He didn't claim to do more than that, but in sorting people's dental disease out, they also lost weight, their rheumatoid arthritis cleared up, their diabetes was resolved, etc., etc. So people beat a path to his door, and he was eventually brought down for marketing a supplement, without sufficient, he was making claims for a supplement or whatever. So they said he was practicing medicine without a license or, some such thing. But nonetheless, he produced a lot of remarkable work. So he did a lot of work on humans, and Ralph Steinman actually did a lot of, he was a research scientist really, and he did a lot of work on rats that showed, how important weaning was and that sort of thing, and the actual mechanism by which that happens, because it's not at all as we think, and it's not at all as we as dentists are told either. It's actually an endocrine problem, decay, tooth decay and gum disease. And I always get this a little bit mixed up, but anyway, it's to do with calcium phosphorus. You need a 4 calcium to 10 phosphorus in the blood. It's actually high calcium causes gum disease and low calcium causes tooth decay, a low calcium to phosphorus ratio. And probably eating dairy throws that out of kilter, as does, sugar and refined foods and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Ralph Steinman actually found that it was a mechanism. It was the endocrine system, the foods you eat change the endocrine signals coming from the pituitary and the hypothalamus, and then the salivary glands in the cheeks. The parotid glands produce a hormone called parotin, and that governs the activity of the odontoblast. So when you start to get tooth decay or gum disease, it's a sign that chronic degenerative disease is 10 years behind. You know, you're sickening already. Because I know friends of mine who are both dentists, you know, many colleagues of mine married dentists, and they brought their children up without any sugar and that sort of thing, and the kids still got decay, and they were absolutely mortified, you know, because we've not been told the right story, really. Yeah. And yes, the emphasis is all on fluoride and, you know, making the surface of the tooth strong, keeping it clean, all that sort of stuff. But, you know, a lot of our efforts aren't really working.
And no.
Probably why, because, you know, I mean, I have to say research, you know, dentists, by the time you become a periodontal professor or something like that, you are not looking at nutrition. You are looking at microbes and how they adhere to the tooth. And, you know, they're so focused in on that niche, tiny little niche.
Yeah.
They're not the big picture.
Exactly. No big picture, not holistic. It's just about the compartmentalized little knowledge and study and specialization. Again, it's not about the whole. And again, that's why we go back to, you know, a holistic approach is just so much better, because you look at everything that is causing the disease.
Well, interestingly enough, you know, doctors know nothing, practically nothing about the mouth. And, you know, that they don't even consider it. It's not even, you know, it doesn't even enter their minds, really. If somebody's sickening, to ask what the state of their mouth is, you know, what kind of bridge work they've got, you know, have they got root canals, you know, just doesn't happen. And then, of course, dentists are doing this work and then not knowing that 6 months later they're getting diabetes, or, you know, because it's not the dentist they come and see. And if they did and they said something to the dentist, then the dentist would say, oh, coincidence, no evidence, blah, 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 blah. But vets who treat the entire animal, the first thing they'll look at is an animal. You know, if they've got a sick animal, they'll look at its mouth. What state is the mouth in? Does it have gum disease? Does it have tooth decay? Does the tooth need to come out? You know, I mean, they're thinking holistically because they've been given the care of the whole body of the animal, whereas we've divided it
up
into.
That's amazing. It's yeah. Funny. We talked about this the other day, actually, with another guest, about how animal care is much better than human care. And here it is again, you know, that they know what to do, but they're not looking at the how to do it, you know.
There was a program on television in the UK a few weeks ago, and it was an experienced farmer and a novice dairy farmer, and she was asking him for advice, and she'd got her field, and he, you know, they'd gone and bought the cows and all that sort of thing. And the first thing he did was took samples of grass and sent them for analysis, mineral analysis. And when they found that the soil was low in, you know, I don't know what, manganese or whatever, they made a lick bucket of all the deficient minerals for the cows, you know. And you think, well, they don't do this for humans.
Yeah.
Nobody's doing mineral analysis for humans, you know. It's just crazy.
And we can, maybe a stupid analogy to make, but if we look at it like an old movie about the Roman Empire or something, when they're having slave trade, the first thing they do is to check out the teeth, you know. Are they in good condition?
Yeah.
You know,
I came across a statistic actually just recently, and you know, just to give you an idea of how bad things were. I mean, you know, it's not that dentistry hasn't achieved anything, because it has.
Mm-hmm.
But in the US, in the First World War, when they were calling up, you know, soldiers, they needed to have six opposable teeth, six sets of teeth,
yeah,
that contacted one another.
Wow.
And they couldn't meet that criteria, so they had to lower it. And, of course, these men would have been, you know, 18, 19.
Oof.
And, you know, they hadn't got six sets of teeth that met, you know, so that was a century ago.
Yeah.
And colleagues of mine who can remember, you know, the aftermath of the Second World War, say it was just, you know, terrible, just disease everywhere. So, you know, we have achieved something, but we've certainly, we accept dental disease as being normal, and it's not. It's not. It's a sign of, you know, degenerative disease.
What causes the endocrine system then to have to attain a disorder that it becomes unbalanced, if we can call it that?
Well, this is all diet. Again, we're coming back to that. And I did get rather off track on this. I'm sorry, because you asked me a question about root canals. I just didn't follow that.
We can go back there if there's more you want to say about that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Melvin Page did lots of work where he could determine the balance of your endocrine system while you were developing, based upon measurements of the calf and the compared to the forearm. And he developed a whole, you know, beautiful system that was lost because his work was, well, it wasn't completely lost. I think it was passed on to Hal Huggins. But nonetheless, it wasn't embraced. I mean, you know, the man had the answer, and we should have all been taught about it in dental school. But, you know, that's not what happened. What happened was his information was killed effectively and went underground, as was Weston Price's work. And Ralph Steinman certainly was an incredibly meticulous researcher too, and produced, you know, lots of, you know, fantastic research. And it's a complex issue. As I say, it's to do with what you wean the young on. That's very critical. And of course, what we mostly give babies is we give them, I don't know, you know, apple or carrot or something easy, don't we, and non-challenging. But those are all carbohydrates. You know, they need protein. And, you know, most of the primitive societies, actually, they've shown that they spit feed or kiss feed. The mum chews the food up and then feeds it into the baby's mouth. So I guess they're getting enzymes and things as well, you know, digestive enzymes, as well as transfer of bacteria and all that sort of thing. But that most babies were weaned, you know, they're breastfed till they're about 3 or 4 in these cultures. And historically, the archaeological record shows that as well. So yes, just things like the introduction of bottle feeding, and, you know, I mean, it's all just a big disaster, really.
Yeah, eating that in the microwave, these formulas, and it just showed how these formulas are like full of poisons and chemicals, and it's, I mean, these Chinese formulas that were, you know, kids were dying having this stuff.
And then you make it up with fluoridated water and
wonderful. Yeah. BPA plastic bottles that you heat up in the microwave and just, you know.
It's well, and also that actually deforms the face as well, the way the teats are compared to, you know, the nipple and the way the baby takes the nipple. So yeah, it's just all, if you didn't think nature knew what it was doing, you know, you would think you could improve on the whole system, wouldn't you? But, you know, once you appreciate that nature is vastly intelligent and there was a system at work and we just messed it all up, it's just a different way of looking at it, really.
Yeah, indeed. How much work have you done in terms of chemicals and phthalates and things in our, let's say, environment, things we touch as opposed to eat and put into our body or not put into our body? And how much this affects, because as I mentioned, we many know about BPA today, but there's, I mean, hundreds of other endocrine disruptors out there that must also then contribute to this, you know, this overall health issue that we have.
Yes, very much so. Well, mercury is what's called a xenoestrogen, which is, it actually both blocks estrogen receptors and mimics estrogen. And a lot of what we're seeing, you know, men with gynecomastia and, I don't know, again, it might not be politically correct to say it, but I think a lot of sexuality has been corrupted as well by, you know, xenoestrogens that are...
Oh, absolutely.
It's messing up the whole...
Absolutely. It's turning everything upside down. And again, it's being viewed as a normal when it's basically just an immense chemical imbalance that's going on within the human body.
I think, you know, when I voice these concerns before, people think I'm blaming somebody. You know, I'm not blaming the people. They're victims of this whole, you know, system.
Exactly.
They can't help it, you know, but it's not normal either. I don't think it's you know, a natural, innate way to be. And we have these problems, you know, with all this kind of sexual confusion, transsexuals, and, you know, so they've got a feminized brain, but, you know, because you're supposed to get these testosterone bursts in utero, and if that doesn't happen or it's not sufficient or whatever, then, you know, you don't become masculinized in body and mind. And so we've got this whole spectrum of sexuality, which I don't think really was, as I say, man's natural state. It's a big old mess.
It is a big mess, and exactly. It's an incredibly important thing, because, again, we're back to that point, Alison, that we talked about earlier. When it comes to reproduction and you know all the issues that we have in terms of basically maintaining the human race, because if this goes far enough and bad enough, we're not going to be in a position where we being able to reproduce anymore. There won't be any human race. This is where what's coming down the road if we continue on the path that we're on right now.
Well, when you realise how bad it is, it's really quite alarming. And you know, a bit like the band playing on the Titanic, I don't think most people get how serious this is. Weston Price, part of his motivation was he wanted to know what had wiped out the 21 civilizations in the last 6,000 years, because he thought, if we don't know that, you know, we're headed down the same pit, really. And I think he's right. And he tried to raise the alarm, and his work was, you know, buried. But it's not too late. But we know, you know, a lot of people just don't have, they just don't have the will to do it, to be honest. Even if they accepted everything I said and, you know, all the rest of it, they just won't stick with it. They just won't. So there's only a certain proportion of people who can A, hear what I'm saying, and B, who've got, you know, who will take responsibility and determine to do it and see it through, because it's tough.
Could that be related to our hormone imbalance as well? That we, even our basic survival is actually diminishing?
I rephrase that question. Do you mean the will, the determination, that sort of thing?
Yeah, if we are so affected by a lot of these hormones, and if we now have hormone disruptors in our system, then this is going to affect maybe even our basic will, our willpower to live or be self-directed. And we, I mean, ultimately, this goes back to control and things like that as well of the human species, you know?
Yes. I mean, I think there's been a lot of manipulation on all kinds of levels, not least the kind of nanny state that, you know, promises it will look after you and what have you until you find out that's not what's happening. It's a multi-layered issue, I think.
Why don't we talk a little bit more about chronic fatigue and how this fits into the picture as well? And were you suffering from chronic fatigue, Alison?
Yes, but you see, I think all of those labels are kind of stupid, really, because it's all mercury poisoning. I mean, if I could have called my book that, I would, but nobody knows they're suffering from it. So,
right. I don't have that, so I don't need to read this. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, yes, I went to see various people, and I was given different labels. One of them was chronic fatigue. One of them was autoimmune disease. One of them was fibromyalgia. And at that point, I just thought, these guys don't know what they're doing. So, you know, if I want to live, and I really thought I was heading down the tracks. My grandmother died when she was 40, 42, something like that. My aunt died when she was 50. I was kind of 42, 43 when the crisis really hit. And, you know, when I kind of woke up and smelled the coffee, I thought, you know, I'm going this way unless I really, you know, pull out of this nosedive. So that was my determination to do it. But it's been hard, you know. But also, I would say, people say, well, how long did it take you? And I think, well, you know, first of all, I didn't know what I was doing when I started. And second of all, I had generational, occupational, personal, and accidental exposure. So I had the mother of all mercury poisoning, you know.
Yeah.
So most people, fortunately, aren't as toxic as I was. And when you know what you're doing, I think you could, you know, expedite the process. But they do say you need to allow for a year of detoxing for every decade of your life of original toxification. So you can, you know, reverse the procedure at about 10 times the speed it originally happened. But nonetheless, for most people, they're looking at, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years of concerted effort to get well.
I'm going through the book a little bit as well. You have a little section there on candida. The yeast, I would assume it's like some kind of, you know, fungus or, you know, parasite, basically. All of these things are related to creating an environment in the body where disease and bacteria and viruses are feeling okay being in, right? Because our immune system is so shot that we can't block these things out anymore. And a lot of this, as you're pointing out, then goes back to being basically mercury poisoning. So we have all these different names on it and all these different diagnoses and everything else. But again, we're going back to the simplicity of it that you said before. It's either two reasons, and it's nutrition or toxicity. And that's it. That's what we should stick to.
That's it. Yeah. Well, you know, this whole idea that you catch viruses and things, you know, this is the Pasteur's idea. And that was, you know, embraced and has been taken up, and, you know, antibiotics, the whole philosophy. There was a rival of Pasteur's at the time, Antoine Beauchamp, and he came up with another theory of the pleomorphism. And the idea was that, and many other people, because his work too was buried or not embraced anyway. And so he gave names to things and symbionts, and then subsequently other people think they've discovered them. And, you know, there's been like a dozen other people think they've discovered this. But, you know, it was all laid down by Anton Beauchamp at the end of the 19th century. And what he said is that there are little vegetative granules in the blood, as he called them pleomorphs or symbionts or whatever. I can't remember who gave what term there. But anyway, their job really is to decompose you when you die and return you to the soil. But when they get the signal, according to how toxic you are, how acidic you are, they morph first into bacteria, then they morph into yeast, and then they morph into viruses when you're extremely toxic. So these things, you're not picking them up from outside, not most of the time anyway. You know, I'm not saying that can't happen. I think if you are in an office with somebody who's sniveling and sneezing and what have you, you know, you possibly can catch a cold, or catch a virus, but nonetheless, you have to be vulnerable to it too. So that was the pleomorphism theory, that these things aren't attacking you from the outside. They're arising from within, according to a very toxic terrain, and nothing will make you toxic, more toxic than mercury, because it is just incredibly potent toxin, and it's made even more toxic within the body. There's a big, very big relationship between being mercury toxic, yes, and having infections of all kinds. Certainly the candida and yeasts, they're in your bodies anyway, but they're normally being controlled by the immune system and the bacteria. And, you know, once the immune system's been knocked out, because that's the first thing that happens with mercury toxicity, the fungi can actually thrive, candida can actually thrive in a mercury-rich environment. It can actually create, in the way our bodies create ATP, adenosine triphosphate, to power everything. They can create energy by converting mercury species. So
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, if you've got athlete's foot or so-called jock itch or thrush, or you get yeast problems in your mouth or whatever, that's all because it's systemic. It's not, you know, in your foot. It's not because you went to the gym and didn't dry your feet properly in the changing room. It's coming out of you. It's within you. So, yeah, you know, but then a lot of people say, oh, well, you need to get rid of the candida, and then they give, herbs and things like that. And to my mind, at least, yes, there's a place for that, because sometimes you just do have to get the upper hand and get this thing under control. But you also need to detoxify and normalize the environment. Otherwise, it will just come back and come back and come back. And, you know, when I first trained and I was kind of following that protocol, you find, you know, people do, they follow the diet for a bit and everything, and then they slip off the wagon, and then 2 years back, they're, you know, later they're back with the same problem. And I didn't find that very satisfactory. As I say, you've got to sort the cause, which is the toxicity, out. And actually, you don't really need to address those particular cause, you know, those particular symptoms, if you like. You don't have to attack the yeast. If you just sort out the toxicity, the body will do the rest. So it makes it easier in a way, although sometimes you do need help to knock out some of the viruses, and because there's usually several layers of viruses, you know, locked in the whole system as well.
Yeah. Remind us again how, I mean, because we're talking about mercury, and one of the worst things as we knowingly are doing it is getting it through the amalgam that we put in our teeth after we drill it. But how did this end up in the amalgam and accepted as a compound to use? What do you know about the history of that?
Yeah, well, it started in 1830 with a man called Green Black, who is regarded as the father of modern dentistry. And he developed a whole system of classification of decay and cavity preparations. And it had been around prior to this time, because they used to use shavings off coins and mix it with mercury. But he kind of officially put the formula together. And the formula of amalgam is half liquid mercury and then half powdered metals, including silver, tin, copper, zinc. So that was introduced in the 1830s or thereabouts. It actually was introduced, obviously, in those days without any kind of testing or prior approval or whatever. And in America, there was a big rumpus because one of the original, the American Society of Dental Surgeons, made their dentist sign a pledge. We had at the time when this was all introduced, there were barber surgeons, so these people weren't, you know, particularly trained or whatever, and there was kind of competition between the barber surgeons who embraced the use of amalgam and then these kind of dentists who trained and were made to sign this pledge that they wouldn't use this stuff. Mm. And eventually all the business was going to the bar, kind of, you know, original barber surgeons, and the society that made them sign the pledge fell apart, and in its wake arose the American Dental Association, who said, that's all right, you don't need to sign any kind of pledge, you can use that stuff. So, you know, the very foundations of the American Dental Association as a pro-amalgam organization. And they hold some of the patents, or certainly did hold some of the patents for amalgam as well, which may be, you know, partly why they so vigorously contest it. Anywho, so yes, that was how it got introduced. If you follow the dots, you know, you can then see that, you know, the first cases of multiple sclerosis occurred, you know, 10, 20 years after that, and then Lou Gehrig's, and, you know, you can see, and then Alzheimer's. Now in Germany, half of all elderly people have or are predicted to have Alzheimer's. And this is just extraordinary. This just didn't happen. You know, and you can see, as I say, if you can see that we're actually passing this stuff on in a generational way, and then we're absorbing, you know, more from our environment and all the medical and dental procedures we're being exposed to as well, you know, and it's not being processed by the body in a lot of people, you can quite clearly see how things have come to pass. And as I say, heart disease has gone from, you know, practically nothing a century ago, to just being a massive killer today.
And look at all these industries now that have grown up around this as well, and donations and charitable work and money is being poured into it. And is it, I mean, from your perspective, is it really reasonable that they are not closer to an answer about a lot of these things? They're looking at genetics and DNA and, you know, other vaccines to prevent these things. And it's like, come on, are they seriously never going to look in the right direction for this? I mean, I don't think that they want to, Alison.
Well, I think, no, I think an allopathically trained doctor is unlikely to reach the truth. And I think that's part of the way the system's set up. Do cancer researchers know what they're doing? No, I think most of them are genuine, you know. Do people at the top know? Yes, I'm pretty sure they do, you know. Mm. If you look at, I don't know if you've heard about Dr. Brzezinski in Texas, and anyway, you've just got to look at how vigorously they go after some people who, you know, do seem to have the answer. Royal Rife was one of them. I don't know if you've heard of him before.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But, you know, his oh, well, you know, they ruined him, and all his equipment kind of mysteriously disappeared and what have you after he died. But he had supposedly and was celebrated for finding the cure for all diseases in the 1920s, and they held a dinner in his honor and everything. And then it all, you know, started to come unstuck in a big way.
It all disappears, the work that they've been doing, hidden under the rug.
Yes, it certainly seems that way. I drifted very far from your question about root canals.
It's okay. Sorry. It's okay. This is good stuff. No, but it's important that we give an idea as well to our listeners of so they can think about this for themselves. If it is so easy, how is it possible that all these millions of dollars and pounds and euros are being poured into these, you know, organizations, and hundreds, if not, you know, tens of thousands of people right now are working on all these things, but yet we're getting more and more sick all the time, you know? What is going on?
Well, it's become an industry in itself, hasn't it? And,
it has, yeah.
You know, I looked at a website a while back, and it was about Alzheimer's, and it was some conference, and they were all there, you know, and it just really struck me that they weren't really looking for the answer, that it was all about egos and grants and careers and, you know, Nobel prizes and glory and all of it. It's just, and you know, I feel really sorry that the public are being duped a lot of the time, because I think they are, and you know, they compete in these, well, we have these moonwalks and all this sort of thing to raise money for cancer research here, and you know, they're doing this in good faith, and it's all you know, we've got the answers right now. We have. We've had the answers for years, but they've been kept from us.
How do you think that it ended up in the, is it a similar scenario of how it ended up in the vaccines with the thimerosal and some of these preservatives? And I mean, most vaccines is a horrible cocktail, of course, if one look at the ingredients of it, despite the fact that there's also, you know, viruses and everything else in there. But do you have any idea about the like approval process here, how that happened?
Well, you know, I mean, the first criticism that's leveled against me, and I have to say, I love science. I've always loved science, but I've also always been quite a spiritual person. I've always known stuff, and this has always been a kind of conflict. And then I see that there doesn't need to be a conflict between science and spirituality. That's just the way it's, you know, been set up. So yes, they say the first criticism is that I'm not scientific, and I think the thing is that We've got it all wrong. Science is wrong. The whole scientific method, the way we go about, you know, exploring these issues is wrong. And I don't know. I was asked for a comment by somebody the other day, and he'd been looking at Alzheimer's brains and, you know, taking samples from here, there, and what have you, and averaging them. And the thing is, if you do, you're losing all the data when you do that, because, you know, somebody may have a lot of mercury in one part of their brain and not a lot in another, and then you're averaging the data over, you know, 100 samples or something, and you've lost all the information. You know, as they say, the average number of legs isn't 2, you know, it's 1.9 something, but nobody really is average, you know.
Yeah.
And just the way they, well, when they do these, when they have to get things through scientific studies, you know, they have a whole load of, they commission a whole load of studies. At the moment, they're not required to give advance notice or anything like that. Then they just cherry pick the data, and then they use cutoff points so that, you know, I think they were shown to have done that with Vioxx, with the heart medication that caused,
yeah,
you know, 100,000 deaths. They knew when they released the drug, but they just used a 3-month cutoff point rather than the 4-month cutoff point or whatever. You can really easily massage data. And the thing is that the researchers who are given these commissions by the pharmaceutical companies or whatever, they know what they're expected to find. And, you know, if you understand quantum physics, even if it is double-blinded, you know, you're still influencing the outcome of the study because of your beliefs.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, it's a dirty business.
It sure is.
And it's got the sheen of science and what have you, but that's all. As soon as you pick, you know, lift the cover and look underneath it, I see it totally differently to the way I saw it, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing. I'm always amazed by people who are just drawn to the numbers and the statistics and whatnot, and just doesn't realize that it's how disconnected it is, after all, to the real world and reality, what's going on. But, you know, as you say, many people don't want to know. They want to try to have the map is not the territory, but people want to look at numbers and paper and documentation instead of just the real world when it's right in front of their eyes. You know what I mean?
Well, it's very confronting. I mean, it was very confronting for me. And, you know, I have to say, when my tutor started at first, when she started to talk about mercury and all this sort of stuff, my hackles used to rise, you know.
Yeah.
And now I just feel so guilty because so many patients raised this issue with me, you know, is this stuff safe? I don't really want it and everything. And I used to parrot what I'd been told, you know.
Yeah.
And I feel terrible now. And, you know, I also didn't know about root canals. I did those. I didn't know any of this stuff when I was a practicing dentist. And that's what motivates me, because I was, you know, I was a genuine person thinking I was doing the best, you know. And I was doing a whole load of harm without realizing it. And,
yep,
you know, not least of which to myself, you know, and to family members. I've done this to my, you know, my sister and my friends, and, you know, I feel terrible. And of course, now I tell them, you know, you really should get those root canal filled teeth out or something, and they don't want to listen to me. But I think, why did you listen to me before? I didn't know what I was talking about then.
Yeah, that's funny, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So do you want me to touch on root canals since we're on that subject?
Oh, sure. Yeah, exactly. Let's go back there again and continue on that.
Okay. So it just taking you back to odontoblasts and the circulation of the cell. So what happens with a root canal, it's usually necessitated because the nerve has died, either because there has been decay and bacteria have got in, all the rest of it, and the nerve has died, or because there's, and quite commonly, actually, there's been a fracture from an existing kind of fairly small filling or whatever. So the nerve has died. What the dentist does is they open up the top of the tooth, they clean out the pulp chamber. So there's meant to be one, the way they draw it in the textbooks anyway, is that there's one canal per root. You clean and file all that out. Sometimes you might seal it up with an antiseptic and get the person back. And then you fill it up with a kind of obturating material and some cement, and then fill it, maybe put a crown on it too, because they get very fragile, so to hold the whole thing together. But the trouble is, the tooth has no circulation. All your odontoblasts have died because you just removed them all if they weren't dead already. And as soon as you do that, the whole milieu of the tooth changes completely. So you've got an anaerobic environment. Any bacteria present, and there will be bacteria present, multiply inside these dentinal tubules. There's 3 miles of dentinal tubules in a front tooth and about 10 miles in a back tooth. And, to a bacteria, they're very roomy. And they multiply very quickly. They become smaller. They start to release really nasty, noxious, toxic substances, thioethers and various other substances, which are 1,000 times more toxic than botulinum toxin. And the thing is that the tooth then starts spewing out these toxins. As you chew, the tooth is in pumped up and down in the socket by the surrounding membrane. So it actually is kind of injecting the stuff into the blood, if you like. So we've got toxins coming from the tooth. We've got bacteria and all sorts of, spirochetes and viruses and all sorts of nasty things. And the important thing is that the immune system can't respond because there is no circulation to the tooth. So it's just constantly trying to fight this battle, which can just exhaust the immune system and the whole system over time. So you can end up with a cancer or chronic fatigue or an autoimmune disease or something like that. The first place all of these toxins and bacteria go is they go to the heart, just because of the way the circulation is set up. And there's a big connection between heart disease and root canal. But it also depends, and we haven't touched upon this, but it depends what meridian
yes.
the tooth is on as
yes.
well.
Yes, I wanted to bring this up, but go ahead and fill in the gaps of the root canal, no pun intended here, first, and then we can get to the meridians.
Well, that's kind of it in essence, really. Things probably go... It's to do with vibration, and specific organisms, bacterial microorganisms, end up in specific organs. So you might get some going to the spleen or pancreas or joints or whatever. And it's all, we don't fully understand all of that yet. So the idea is that basically you've just preserved a dead organ in your body. That's, and it doesn't matter how cleverly it's done. There are people called endodontists who are specialist dentists who, specialise in doing root canal treatments. And, they do a great job, very meticulous and all that sort of thing. But, first of all, there isn't one canal per root. Most of the time it's an incredibly complex system. It's not really root canal, it's a root system with interconnecting canals and lateral canals. And there's about 75 lateral canals per root. So, even with the best intention in the world, it's just impossible to clean all that out and fill it up. But as I say, the real problem is the structure of dentine. So a lot of biological dentists they won't do root canals. They don't think there's any such thing as a good root canal. A lot of people have got a lot better from an awful lot of horrible conditions by getting their root canal teeth removed. And it depends, as I say, which meridian it's on. The idea is really that we're not physical beings as allopathic medicine thinks of us as being, but we're really light beings, and that we're absorbing light in it as photons from the environment, and it's being reduced through a series of transformers known as chakras and then fed into the meridian system. And there's a central meridian running up and up the center of the body, and then that feeds into 12 bilateral meridians, and all of these meridians go through a tooth or its socket. Mm. So you can sometimes, for instance, a front tooth, an incisor, is on the meridian for reproduction and bladder. So, you know, it's quite common to get a sporting injury or something like that, have a broken front tooth, say, you know, as a teenager, you had a root canal or something like that. And then, you know, 15 years on, you try for a baby and you can't, you know, and get pregnant and you don't understand why and everything. And nobody thinks to connect the fact that you've got a root canal on your, you know, meridian that's affecting your reproductive organs.
It's blocking the energy flow there, basically.
Yeah, well, it's not only blocking the flow, but it's spewing toxins and microorganisms as well.
Yeah.
But sometimes the connection isn't quite so clear cut. And I have to say, a lot of biological dentists are just really getting wise to this, and they're having their root canal filled teeth out, and they're reporting, you know, almost everybody reports an improvement in their health. And sometimes it might be, you know, they had the tooth out and the pain that they had in their knee for 20 years is gone, or so it's a little unpredictable. But
so tell us more about having it out. What do you mean taking out the whole tooth then, or what are we talking about?
Yes, sadly that is what we're talking about, and that needs to be handled properly as well, because if that's not done properly, then you can just exchange one problem for another.
Mm-hmm.
The way most dentists, including me, extracted teeth was that we, you know, anesthetized the person and so forth, and then extracted the tooth. But what we didn't do was we left the periodontal membrane in situ, and also there's a layer of compact bone which is suspending the tooth in its socket with these periodontal, it's just a modified ligament. So these fibres are going from the cementum on the root of the tooth into the compact bone around the tooth. So what happens when you extract the tooth is, you know, regardless of whether you form a blood clot or not, the membrane actually has lost half its blood supply, because the whole tooth and jaws all developed as a dentoalveolar complex, as it's called. So that can become necrotic. It can also act as a barrier along with the surrounding bone, which prevent progenitor cells getting into any blood clot that may form, and healing the whole thing. And what happens, you know, 95 times out of 100 is you apparently get healing. So there's a thin eggshell of bone grows over the top, the gum will heal. But underneath there is a cavity in the bone, and we call these cavitations, or NICOs, which stands for neuralgia-inducing cavitational osteonecrosis. And this is very, you know, under-recognized. But again, that is spewing forth toxins, bacteria, and until it's opened up, you know, identified, opened up, cleaned out properly and allowed to heal, to get a good blood clot there and to heal properly, a lot of people get, you know, some very weird symptoms, degenerative disorders and so forth.
Would you notice any of this around the area where the tooth has been removed?
You wouldn't, and that's a lot of the time you wouldn't, put it that way. I think a chronology might help you. So if you think back and you think, oh yes, you know, ever since I had that wisdom tooth out or whatever, I've had symptom X, Y or Z. Wisdom teeth, in particular lower wisdom teeth, it is said 98% form cavitations. Lower molar teeth, 90% plus. You can muscle test them. You can sometimes see them on X-ray, but you'd have to have a dentist who knew what he was looking for. There was a system called Cavitat where they used sonic, you know, equipment with a computerized program, mm-hmm, to detect cavities in the bone. You maybe see them on a CAT scan or something like that, but you know, again, it depends who's looking at the CAT scan. So they're kind of hard to diagnose, actually, and you need a biological dentist who really knows what they're looking for and knows how to look for it. But yeah, muscle testing is actually... Also, I would say if somebody has had a so-called dry socket or an infected socket, so they went back to the dentist, they were in a lot of pain, after an extraction. You know, the blood clot either hadn't formed or it had formed and it had been dislodged, and they probably had it cleaned out and had a dressing put in and maybe were given antibiotics, something like that. So if you've got any history of that having happened, that's the red flag as well. I mean, there are dentists, still unfortunately numbering only in their hundreds probably, who are au fait with all of this stuff, who you can go and see. And biological dentistry is a bit of a mixed bag as well, because some of them really, they're really hot. Almost all of them accept that mercury is toxic and take it out with care, but not all of them accept the problems posed by root canal and cavitation. So you do need to kind of, do your homework. And
Any good tips on where people could turn, let's say within Europe or the States, to begin there to find some of these people?
Yeah, I've got a useful contact page on both my websites, and I try and keep an up-to-date list of organisations, that sort of thing. The International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology, IAOMT, maintains a listing of all the people who meet their, who've trained with them and who meet their criteria. So that's IAOMT.org. So they're a good place to go. I've got some other organisations listed as well. It does depend what you're looking for. I've also got an article on finding a biological dentist, which goes through, what are you looking for, and, how to go about finding it and the questions you should ask and all that sort of thing, on both of the websites. So that's worth looking at. But
right.
It is a minefield.
Yeah.
particularly at this time, because we're at a transition time, really, there's more and more dentists getting this. But, it's still on the periphery and it's still being stamped on. And a lot of these dentists keep a fairly low profile because, they don't want to lose their licenses, basically.
Sure, sure.
So you often have to go looking for them. And, word of mouth is a good way to go as well. And then I would just...
Guerrilla dentistry, yeah.
So,
I would
ring. Amazing. And, get their leaflets and then ring and, quiz their receptionists about what they do about this, that and the next and what have you. So, it's just so important. I mean, it is said by people who are able to identify these things that 90% of disease starts in the mouth. So, it's just played a huge causative role and it's gone completely unrecognized. And, that was my inspiration for setting up Mouth Body Doctor anyways, to kind of look at that whole, explore that whole area.
Very good. Yeah, excellent. Exactly. Bringing some information to the forefront about this and highlighting this to people as a very important connection, and the meridian points in the teeth. That's very interesting as well. I've never heard about that before. What about vitamins, supplements, and then even just food? What foods to eat for, let's say, well, both for nutritional purposes, but also for detox purposes, perhaps. Anything to recommend, Alison?
Yes, I didn't finish my point earlier, earlier train of thought, did I, when you asked me about detoxing? Well, first of all, you need protein. You need protein at every meal, and you need animal protein, really. So that could be eggs, and just don't worry about, you can't have too many eggs, really, unless you go completely crazy. Protein at every meal, because you need the amino acids to detoxify these metals. It's required. You just can't do it if you're vegan or vegetarian. I just haven't seen anybody get well on that diet. And I know people like Hal Huggins, who's a specialist in this. He won't treat vegans and vegetarians, not because he's unkind, because he just knows that he's not going to get the results, and he doesn't want to take the money under false pretenses. So you've got to eat protein at every meal. So, a good breakfast would be, I have scrambled eggs with smoked salmon. That would be one of my breakfasts.
Let me ask about the cooking again then there, because I've heard that scramble is one of the worst ways that you can do it, because you're heating basically all the different surfaces of the egg. And this is actually, I don't know about all the scientific terminology here, but this is just what I've heard anyway, that because people are concerned with the cholesterol, in terms of eggs and all that. And we talked about fat before, but the way it's actually has to do with the way you cook it, apparently. And it's better to eat, let's say, maybe boiled, but not completely boiled through. So it's kind of semi-runny still. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes. I think just forget the cholesterol thing completely. I mean, that one has been shot down years ago, except by the fight. So just don't worry about cholesterol. But there is a protein in eggs called avidin, which you don't, if you have eggs, too many raw eggs anyway, isn't very good for you. So that's partly where this runny thing came from, that you should have a parboiled egg or lightly boiled egg or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't heard that one. It's an interesting thought that, a scrambled egg, an omelette or something like that. I'm just, forget the cholesterol thing. It's just,
sure.
No evidence to support it at all. And God or nature made foods perfect, really. He made whole foods, and an egg isn't a whole food. And if you, as soon as you start having egg white pasta and all this sort of thing,
not that. Well, again, yeah. I just, the way I see it is that, like, if you have a snake or whatever in the wild eating an egg, they do not go and scramble it. You know, they just eat it as it is with the shell and everything.
yeah, they do. Yeah. Animal protein, good fats, good clean animal fats. So yellow butters, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Vitamins, you need to take a decent amount of vitamin C. We actually used to make vitamin C endogenously once upon a time,
right.
And
yeah.
We can't now. And, I don't think anybody knows why. That seems a little mysterious.
Interesting.
But our nearest ape neighbours, chimpanzees and things like that, they do. And they actually manufacture about 17 grams of the stuff a day. So you're talking about, the current recommendation in the UK is 60 micrograms.
Wow.
It's just laughable. Jeez. So just forget about worrying about, maximum doses, I would say. And you probably need something in the order of 2, 3, 4 grams of vitamin C a day.
But you said chimpanzees are 17 grams.
17 grams.
That's a lot.
A day.
Wow.
That's,
okay,
yeah.
They're a little bigger in mass, I think, as well.
But, well, not a chimp.
Not a chimp, maybe. Yeah.
No, a gorilla. A gorilla would be. But
right.
So, somewhere along the line, we lost that. And other animals can. I think goats can and mice can, and but we can't. Who knows what happened there? But it does seem a little odd. Struggling to remember the name of the guy who did the work on vitamin C. He got two Nobel Prizes for it.
I know whom you're talking about. I can't think of it either at this moment. We'll return to it. Yeah.
He took something of the order of 18 grams a day and recommended that everybody else do likewise. I would say, at least 2, 3, 4 grams a day. And then, if you're sick or whatever, up that, and don't worry about maximum doses, really, within reason. Is an antioxidant. It also helps to convert the mercury into forms that you can excrete. Essential oils, omega-3, something like that. Psyllium husks, because you want to be absorbing stuff, and chlorella pyrenoidosa. Is a algae which can absorb all kinds of toxins, and the idea is that you take that kind of half an hour before a meal, and that's when your gallbladder contracts and squirts the bile that's full of toxins. It will be absorbed by the chlorella. Clays as well, you can use bentonite clays or pyrophyllite clays, and they will magnetize all kinds of toxins out of your system. One thing I would say is quite a lot of natural health people attempt to pull the toxic metals out via the kidneys and the urine, and I think that's a really bad idea, because the kidneys have taken a hammering, and your kidneys have got quite a kind of small working surface area. They don't repair well, if at all, and you can seriously permanently damage your kidneys. If you bring the toxins out via the liver and via the intestines, you've got a huge working surface area, and both of those organs can regenerate, So I would, some naturopaths use intravenous chelation and that sort of thing, but it's putting an incredible tax on the kidneys, I think, to do it that way. And there may be some role for doing a little bit of that, but I think the bulk of it you want to pull out via the bile and stool.
Mm, yeah, but by the way, you were thinking about Linus Pauling.
Linus Pauling, that's the one,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's the kind of broad outline. But then it helps to give some liver support as well. So something like milk thistle. But I'd also say that, you know, you kind of do one thing for 3 months and then you do kind of a little bit of a liver cleanse and then maybe a bit of a colon cleanse and then you go back to it for, you know, so it's not just, you just don't do one thing all the way through. As I say, you're going to be at this for years. So, you know, you just, oh, and the other thing is liver flushes as well. Liver flushes are different to liver cleanses. Liver flushes are a way of flushing out all the stones that have accumulated in the ducting in the liver and gallbladder. And you can do it various ways. The system I use uses Epsom salts, followed by grapefruit juice, a mixture of 50-50 grapefruit juice and olive oil. And the Epsom salts cause the sphincters and the muscles to relax, and then the grapefruit and olive oil causes the gallbladder to contract really hard and force out any, and the liver to contract, and any stones to be forced into the colon, and then you have another drink of Epsom salts to flush that all through. I've done somewhere of the order of 50 of those now, and I've got out over 5,000 stones, some of which were, one was as big as a golf ball, and one was about what? The size of a mouse, sort of thing. No. So oh, I've just got an immense amount of rubble out of my liver and gallbladder. And, you know, until you get that out, I think all the supplements, et cetera, or at least attempt to get that out, you know, they're not going to work while your system is so congested and so locked. You just can't get the toxins out the bile. And there's all sorts of other things you can do, enemas, coffee enemas and things. I mean, all the kind of, you know, natural health.
Oh, really? Stuff. The Gershon thing with the coffee enemas? You're a proponent of that?
Yeah, that causes the same sort of thing. It causes the liver to dump bile, and so you're getting the toxins out and getting the stones out too. And once you start on this, you start to pass stones spontaneously, or at least you notice you did. Perhaps you did before and didn't notice. it all adds up, but it's work. It's asserted work over a period of time.
Oh, yeah, indeed.
But, I mean, for me, as I say, I've got two parents who ended their life with Alzheimer's, so that's motivation enough for me.
Yeah, I understand that. Well, that's very interesting. There's a lot of material here, of course, to wade through and dive through, and you have much more on the websites about it. And of course, the book as well. The book title again for everyone is The Chronic Fatigue, ME, and Fibromyalgia, The Natural Recovery Plan. Give us the websites again, Alison, so people know where to go then.
Yeah, sure. One website is www.thenaturalrecoveryplan.com. And that is the site to go for. I've got lots of videos, podcasts, articles there. And that is if you are concerned about the effects of dental treatment and you're looking to recover. So I've got lots of information about recovering from chronic, serious and degenerative illness there. And then the other website is www.mouthbodydoctor.com, and that specifically looks at the effect of dental treatment on health, metals, different procedures, and also the systemic nature of most dental disease as well. So there is some overlap between the two sites, but it depends on your interest. So I'm hoping to have some more. I'm hoping to put some DVDs together by the end of the year of lectures on mercury issue and the mouth-body connection, and also to produce a series of mouth-body doctor guides to various issues, so like root canals and things, just little, you know, little things that will be available on Kindle and what have you. So, but in the meantime, I've got lots of videos and things that explain all these issues in depth, and lots of articles as well.
Indeed. Yeah, absolutely. Very good. More information on the websites, of course, about that. Well, thank you, Alison. We appreciate this. Thank you for sharing your background story with us. It's been a long and a gruesome one, of course, but it's really important stuff to share some of this work with people. So we do appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. And thank you so much for the work you do, too. I'm regularly listening to Red Eye.
All right, my friends. Thank you for listening. Great to have you with us. We feel proud and fortunate that you want to spend some of your time with us and learning about many of the subjects that we find essential investigating. Some are just too important to stay away from, while others demand further inquiry and questioning. Big thanks to all our members. I want to extend my thanks to Frederick, Lana, and Elizabeth as well for their hard work. We'll be back in just a few days. Stay sweet and drink some bitter tea. Talk to you then.